committee for selecting me, as well as Bridget and Clint for organizing a great conference. And actually, this Kotaro, who is somewhere back there, who after meeting me 3 days ago, gave me his computer and his password so that I could present today. I'm not kidding. So he would tell you today about some work that I've been doing in David Agard's lab in collaboration with the Davis Lab at University of Washington to solve the atomic structure of the microtubule, of the gamma-tubulin small complex, and try and understand what the implications are in terms of its regulation. So as I'm sure many of you know, microtubules are involved in a number of very important cellular processes, including cellular division. And so if you look at a three-dimensional image of one of these large networks that are formed by microtubules, illustrated here in a cryo-EM tomogram collected by Sam Lee in our lab. So this is a yeast spindle, and you follow these microtubules to their minus end. What you'll find at the minus end is this conical structure here, which nucleates the microtubule, which we call the gamma-tubulin ring complex, or the gamma-turk. This is formed of a heptamer of a gamma-tubulin small complex. So it's 300 kilodalton heterotetramer formed of two gamma-tubulins, GCP2 and 3. This is anchored in the spindle pole body by this coiled-coil protein, SBC110. And what a number of us in the lab are working on is trying to understand how gamma-tubulin small complex is trying to understand the structure of the gamma-tusk and the gamma-turk, as well as its assembly and activation. So work from Justin Coleman in the lab showed that SBC110, which anchors gamma-tusk at the spindle pole body, actually acts not only to anchor it at the spindle pole body, but also acts to assemble.
Excuse me, sorry, your microphone is off.
It's off?
If you turn it off, I
don't know. Maybe I'm just not.
Are so good in me,
don't know. Let me see. All right. How much of that did you miss?
No, we all got it. It's just recording for the website.
Oh, okay, all right. Oh, wow, that's loud now. I'll have to tone it down. So you take gamma tusk, you add SPC110, and now what you find is that it's assembled into gamma turks, and if you use the right construct, as Justin Coleman did, he was able to form these nice long helical filaments. Using these helical filaments, he was able to solve the structure of the gamma turk, and what he sees is that you get 6.5 subunits per turn, which exposes 13 gamma tubulins, and of course this matches the in vivo microtubule protofilament number. Very consistent with it acting as a microtubule nucleator, of course. What was a little surprising in this structure is that if you look here, so this is a single gamma tubulin small complex, what you find is that at the interface between the gamma tubulins, the intergamma-tubulin distance doesn't match the microtubule symmetry. So this distance is 63 angstroms. Interestingly, actually, the intergamma-tusk interface does match the microtubule symmetry. Of course, he quickly understood that this meant that there must be another activation step. What he was able to do is actually design disulfide crosslinks at the in vivo interface here. And once this was in its reduced state, he was able to solve a now higher resolution structure where the intragamma tusk and intergamma tusk distances match the microtubule symmetry, and where if you model now a microtubule, you find that it actually matches the microtubule symmetry perfectly. This, of course, indicated that. Closed state does actually in vitro act as a better microtubule nucleator, suggesting that closure does act as a regulatory mechanism. Using this now higher resolution structure in a collaboration with the Salih Lab and Charles Greenberg specifically, they were able to use a previously determined crystal structure, GCP4, which is the shortest of these subunits It's less than 20% similar to GCP2 and 3 here to generate a pseudo-atomic model of the gamma-tubulin ring complex. Of course, their model was still missing 200 plus amino acids from both GCP2 and 3, and of course it was built into this 6.5 angstrom map. And so what we wanted to do, what I wanted to do, was to improve the precision of this model. And in order to do that, I used a single particle approach, which I guess is popular these days, using a modified version of Justin Coleman's purification. I was able to obtain nice micrographs now, and so what you're looking at here is a raw micrograph. I should say that these gamma tusks like to assemble at around 1 micromolar, which is the concentration kind of held to as an upper limit. And what you actually see in the raw micrographs, for example, here you see a monomer, and here you'll see tetramers. So I have a mixed population of oligomeric states in my data. Nevertheless, I was able to use classification to solve 3.8 angstrom structure of the gamma tubulin small complex. I should mention that the model was built using methods previously talked about by David, specifically Rosetta. So in our lab, we have Ray Wang, who was very helpful in terms of providing advice in using Rosetta. And so, you know, you can see maybe that there's features consistent with the 3.8 angstrom map. And in addition to that, I was also able to solve the structure of this tusk dimer, which is a 4.6 angstrom map. So this is just the monomer structure fitted into the dimer, right? This provided us with our first atomic description of the gamma tusk. There are numerous inserts in the structure, and it was, you know, we actually didn't know what the true register of the sequence was until we were able to solve the structure. We can now see the differences in the interfaces between the gamma tusk's internal interface versus inter-gamma tusk interface, and now start to look at questions about conformational changes in gamma tubulin assembly and interpret these phosphorylation sites. In order to get at this map, I followed a fairly standard workflow. So I used, I did my drift correction in Motion Core 2. This works very well. I actually use a few different parameters and pick the best ones. I pick my micrographs in EMAN 2. I very much like that interface. The CTF was determined in CTF Find 4 by Alexi. I use Relion to do the particle extraction. I do 2 rounds of 2D classification just to get rid of junk. What I do actually is an initial round to get my initial angles. I do this in Relion. I don't run it to convergence. I just run about 10 cycles, and then I actually extract all of I migrate all of the orientational assignments, but only the orientational assignments, to Freeline. And I do a more expensive, but since Freeline is a little faster, this is a bit more practical, classification into 15 classes. I pick out my singlet and doublet classes, separate them, align them into one class, followed by a second round of 3D classification. So the structure I showed you earlier is one of 3 classes, and it's the best resolved one, 3.8 angstroms. And for the dimers, I have 2 classes there. Of course, we were limited at 3.8, and we had kind of set this target of 3.5 angstroms to get an accurate register and really to be able to accurately interpret our map. I actually tried a lot of things. One of the first things I tried, and this is usually the most tried and true way to get to higher resolution, is I added 500,000 particles. That's still running, so I won't tell you about it today. another thing that I tried was a number of different programs. So I tried Relion, I tried CryoSpark. I tried running the full workflow as well as giving them the classification results from Freeline. I wasn't able to actually much improve the map, My best result is still Freeline. Maybe it's just because I know how to use it better. I did spend 5 years in Nico's lab. Tried the focus classification in Freeline, so that was trying to get at some of the more uncorrelated some of the more uncorrelated heterogeneity. Specifically, we do have some regions that are less good, and we were hoping that they might have some rigid body motions that we'd be able to extract from the correlated motions that we were observing. But all that I was able to actually pull out was these correlated motions. And in addition to that, I tried a number of shaped masks. So, you know, the base, one of the arms, the other arm. None of these improved anything. And I think in a number of cases, they actually decreased the resolution. I think because my signal to noise, I had to image in relatively thick ice. So I'm still alignment limited to a certain extent. One thing which did help is something that Nico talked about a little bit yesterday. What you can do is you can use a shaped mask. And so here what you see is that is actually kind of implicitly the shape of my mask. I use a mask which contains GCP2, one gamma tubulin, GCP3, the base of GCP2, and this gamma tubulin, and excludes this gamma tubulin as well as some of the GCP2. I knew from my classification results that this was the most heterogeneous portion. And outside of the mask, what Nico has implemented is you now filter your data so that it's still included, but at lower resolution in your alignments, and you can actually downnoid it as well. This improved my resolution from 3.8 to about 3.5. I'm showing, you know, three FSCs here. This is the free align one. It says 3.5. The other one is just a tight mask and a loose mask. So using these now better models, we were able to get a slightly better model and as well, you know, now start to interpret these maps. And the first thing that we were very interested in, am I almost out of time?
Yeah.
2 minutes?
2 minutes.
All right, I got 2 minutes. That's good. All right. is, you know, look at these assembly-driven conformational changes. Here I have two monomers here. I'm undergoing the conformational transition from the monomer to the assembled but inactive state, and what you see is these changes that occur initially during assembly, where the gamma tubulin swings out. Now upon activation, what you see is this allosteric conformational change, where the gamma tubulin swings in and it adopts the active conformation. By fitting now my structures into these three states, two of them from Justin, one from me, we're able to see that actually the main conformational change underlying these kind of more global conformational changes was just a twist of the N-terminus of the GCP domains. The N-terminus of the GCP domain relative to a constant C-terminal GCP domain. In addition, one of the questions that we were asking was what happens to the gamma tubulin upon assembly into the gamma tusk? We wanted to know whether it was kept inactive or whether it was active. Of course, if it's inactive, then there has to be some other activation step that occurs. And so kind of canonically with microtubules, what you have is a bent and a straight state. Here what I'm showing you is this human gamma tubulin crystal structure. This is free. And what you see is it adopts the canonical bent state where helix 6 is in this position. There's a slight piston motion of helix 7 here and a motion of the loop. From work from Luke Rice's lab in collaboration with Evan Agalis, gave us the straight beta yeast structure. And what we noticed was that even though gamma tubulin bound to SBC98 or GCP3 was not in this kind of canonical bent or straight, the loop appeared to be close to a straight conformation. And we see this now from the side, looking at the interface in this modeled gamma alpha interface. And here, looking at the clashes in red with the human gamma, we see that a lot of these clashes are actually alleviated once 98 is bound to the gamma tusk. And so we notice here that this loop is that the changes here in this loop are due to the conformational changes because this loop is conserved. The changes here are actually just due to species specific. This loop is shorter in yeast gamma. Do I have any time left? 10 seconds?
You should finish up.
All right, cool. We were able to look at the phosphorylation sites with data from Trish's lab. So a few of these stood out, specifically some of the SPC110 binding interface. Right here at this interface, you have a negatively charged region interacting with this positively charged. You can imagine what the effect of adding a couple of phosphates there would be, specifically inhibiting recruitment. In addition, we now had this phosphate here at the C-terminus of GCP2. If we look in our dimer structures, we actually have density reaching over, and here we have an arginine. So we think this is involved in promoting assembly. All right, cool. Acknowledgements. So of course, David Agard, great scientist, great boss. The people that I work with most closely in the lab, Andrew and Michelle, our collaborators, Trisha's lab, and our greater collaborators in the SPB group. Oh, and specifically by name, our EM core, Michael Braunfeld, Alex, David, they run our microscopes. Cameron and Matthew run our computers.
Okay, thanks, let's do that. So we have time for one question.
So I saw you put your total dose is 80 electrons per square angstrom, right? So, but then I guess you use dose weighting or?
Dose weighting, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. In motion core, thanks to Tim Grant for giving us actually those curves ahead of publication.
Maybe one more question while Jessica's setting up.
Cool. I'll just talk loud.
Hi. Mine is more biological question.
Great.
So, can you hear me? Yeah. How do you think that the crowding in the cell can affect the assembly of the microtubule? Because you study in vitro, right?
Yes. Well, our collaborators do a lot of in vivo work.
Do you have any information about the kinetic? Yeah. No. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's give Axel another round of applause.
Is the mic on?
I think so, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's on. Oops.
All right, so next up is Jessica Gibbons. She'll tell us about ribosome assembly.
Okay, so first I'd like to thank the committee minus Dimitri for selecting me for this talk. And I'd also like to thank Anrim for sponsoring this really wonderful conference. So my project focuses on, I think, almost every cryo-electron microscopist's favorite molecule, the ribosome. And particularly, I've been working on the E. coli ribosome. And my main question is, how does the 50S subunit assemble into its mature form? So we know that ribosomes are responsible for protein synthesis in the cell, and that they're highly complex and have two subunits. And these involve multiple long stretches of folded rRNA and have about 50 proteins. And in the case of the E. coli ribosome, it has a 30S small subunit and a 50S large subunit, which is shown here, spinning around. The two RNAs are in white and gray, respectively, and you can see the proteins that decorate the outside of the surface. Now, all of these components must assemble into an ordered complex. This happens co-transcriptionally along with the transcription of the rRNA and also co-translationally with the R proteins as well as modifications of the R proteins and the rRNA itself. What we know about ribosome assembly comes from work by the Nierhaus group back in the 60s and 70s. And while this work has been extremely powerful, these experiments were done by in vitro constitution experiments where they purified the individual components and then used high non-physiological amounts of magnesium and high temperatures in order to get the ribosome to go to its mature state. However, this gives us a great map, which is here, where you can see the black lines that show the thermodynamic dependences of these R proteins on each other and on the 23S and the 5S rRNA that's shown there. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to more clearly annotate what happens in vivo, because since you have high non-physiological amounts of magnesium and high temperature steps, it's very unclear how faithful this in vitro reconstitution is to true in vivo conditions. So in the Williamson lab, we've developed a genetic approach to deter the biogenesis of the large subunit. So what we do is we can knock out a particular R protein of interest in the E. coli genome, and then we reintroduce it under the control of an inducible promoter. And then that allows us to control the level of timing of our R protein production, and it lets us starve the cells for a particular R protein of interest. And then we can use a sucrose gradient in order to get a perturbed sucrose gradient profile and to separate out the intermediates. So for a lot of the background, I'm going to show you previous work that has been done on the large ribosomal subunit. So this is a side view, and it shows where L17 binds, because it's the first protein that we've studied. So when we do the sucrose gradient profiles, this is showing sucrose the gradients under two different conditions. The first in the black curve is under high HSL conditions. This means we're not really starving the E. coli for an R protein. You can see a fairly normal sucrose gradient for a ribosome. You see a 30S peak, a 50S peak, and a pretty large 70S peak. However, when we limit the amount of R protein in our system, and that's done by dropping the HSL concentration down to about 0.2 nanomolar, you can see we have a dramatic difference in our sucrose gradient. So we still see the 30S, granted at very high levels. You can see the 70S at decreased levels. And now what we're seeing is we're seeing an intermediate peak around that we call a 45S. So what we did is we took fractions along the sucrose gradient and then took the topmost peak of the 45S peak and used cryo-EM to try to solve some of these structures. So the data was collected on a Titan Krios with a K2 camera. In the initial data set, it was about 150,000 particles were collected, and this work was done by Yang Zi. And whenever he did an initial round of classification, what he found was there were four main classes that fell out, B, C, D, and E class, ranging from the most immature class, which is the B class here, to almost fully mature E class. Subsequent 2D classification on each one of these intermediates showed that there were subclasses within all of these. And so we had a total of 13 structures that range from about 4 to 5 angstrom resolution. And it's important to know that these are not dead end or degradation products. And we have mass spectrometry data that shows that's not the case. And so in order to try to quantitate the differences between our different intermediates, we moved to what we call an occupancy analysis. So basically what we did was we generated a theoretical density for each protein in helix from a docked PDB structure. And then for each map, we calculated the fraction of the mature density that was occupied. So a good example here, this is structure E1 and D1. So you can see that some of these helices are fully occupied for E1, but you have density missing for helix 62, 63, 54, 58, and helix 34. So in order to more easily visualize this, we can kind of put this into a matrix, where this dark blue represents full occupancy. And then you can see for some of these helices for the D1 class, you can see indeed they're lighter blue, indicating that they don't have as much occupancy. So now we can ask the question, well, how does the occupancy of each helix and protein really vary across our intermediates? Okay, so what we get is this large data matrix here. So what's not shown is the names of the proteins and the helices down here on the x-axis. We have our different classes on the y-axis, and then you can see we have all the occupancies, and again, a dark blue means full occupancy. Anything that's white or light blue means that it doesn't have very much occupancy. And what you can immediately start to see is we have classes of density or groups of density that are missing for each class. So for example, this block here, which we're calling block 2, which is missing in all the C classes, and you have these two blocks that are missing in the D classes. So what we're able to do is, so what we've been finding, which is really interesting, is that you really have these blocks of ribosome assembly. And then we can take this one step further, so we can calculate the median value for each block, for each class. And that's what this data looks here. So again, we have the occupancy analysis for each of the blocks here on the y-axis, and on the x-axis is each class. And what we see is these blocks really co-localize on the tertiary structure. And from this, we can identify the folding domain boundaries. What's really interesting that these are in real space and not in sequence space. So for example, you can see block 4, which is in red, where you have things from domain 2 and domain 5 of the 23S rRNA. So two questions that kind of came out of this analysis was, first, have we recovered all the intermediates present in the data? And second, are these structures representative of ribosome assembly, or are these just unique because we've knocked out BL17? So I'll answer the first question first because it's very simple. No, we have not really found all the intermediates. So Dimitri has gone back and reprocessed some of the L17 data, and so far he's found 24 unique structures in the L17 data, which of course is more than the 13 structures that we had originally identified. The second question is a little bit more complicated to answer. So for this, we've stepped back and we've created libraries of protein depletion strains. So the ones I've been working with, so we went back and we collected the L17 data set in order to try to see if we can tease out even more intermediates. And also we've chosen to follow up on a couple of the later binding intermediates to try to decouple some of the L17 specific binding events from general ribosome assembly. And so we followed up on L28, L32, and L34. So this data gets complicated quite fast. So what I've been doing after a couple of data cleaning steps, I've been using FreeInline X to do 25 model single particle classification. And then these are the results for the L34 depletion strain. So these are clustered according to the protein occupancies, the same occupancy analysis we did for L17. And what we find is, you know, you have a fully mature 70S, you have a lot of these more mature fat intermediates, and then you have some of these intermediates where the central protuberance is misdocked. Furthermore, whenever we do the occupancy analysis and look at these large groups, again, I know it's hard to read, but more possible to read, but we have the proteins and helices down on the x-axis and the y are the different classes. Again, we're seeing these kind of blocks falling out for all of these structures. And this is very common across all the strains. So here I have these occupancy matrices for each of my protein strains, and they're color-coded for, so you can easily see them. And again, we see this block-like pattern forming. So the reason why, so when we look at this individual data set, we get a lot of information about the interdependence of different R proteins whenever you have a factor missing. So we can use this type of information to tease out new interactions in the near house map. However, in order to get a view of what actually is going on in ribosome and biogenesis and get things that are common for ribosomes and not just specific to a particular R protein limitation, we can combine all this data together and do a global clustering, which is what you see here. So this is the same data from the slide before. We've just clustered them all together. So again, the proteins and helices are here on the x-axis. We have the different classes here on the y-axis, and then I followed the same color scheme as before. Again, where you see dark blue, you have full occupancy. Light blue or white, you have no occupancy. And very similarly to the L17 data, we see 5 or 6, if you count this class here, blocks of occupancy kind of falling out. So example, you have a block here, and you have a couple of blocks here where proteins are either there or absent. So again, we can use this type of classification because the theory is where you see large chunks of densities present or missing, you're able to more clearly annotate what the ribosome is actually going through. So the classes that are unique, you can to one particular protein strain, you can kind of start to tease out. And so we're really trying to use this in order to get a better picture of our in vivo ribosome assembly. So eventually we can take the intermediates that we find that are in common and place them in a movie so you can kind of see the densities building up as the ribosome matures. And this will give us a more complete view of ribosome assembling in vivo. However, this does present quite a lot of challenges for cryo-EM analysis since this is quite large heterogeneous data sets. And I haven't shown the data, but you really have to be careful with your classification strategies. Long story short, I was going back through my L17 data, and my least mature class has disappeared. And then I panicked, went through a data analysis again a little bit, and I was able to recover that class. And then this also leads to two kind of interesting classes that I think we've talked about a lot over the past couple days. When are you really done classifying? And then how do you determine statistically significant differences between your intermediates or your conformations? And those are two questions that I'm following up as I chase down the biology for these ribosomes. So to wrap up, I'd like to thank people in the Williamson Lab, especially Jamie and Joey Davis, who originally worked on the L17 data set. He's now at MIT. I'd also like to thank members of the Lumkus Lab, especially Dimitri and Yang Min, who prepared the grids for me and helped me with their microscope setup. I'd like to thank Bill, who keeps the scripts, the microscopes at scripts running, and Yang Zi, who did the initial classification on the microscopy on the original L17 data set, and of course, my funding sources. And thank you all for listening, and I will take any questions. I haven't completely run over my time.
Yeah, so in the, going back to the point of the classification, so at the end what you are showing us that is those structures that refine well at the end, right? But I'm sure on the process of classifying, then you end up finding these classes in which, you know, they look like really ugly, and then we wonder, are those damaged particles? Are they, you know, still too flexible to be able to refine? So what's been your criteria to deal with those classes that you're finding?
So what we've been doing is if the resolution is reaching a certain limit, so my structures are reaching below 3 to 4 angstroms, so if we have a structure at 10 angstroms, we know something is going on. So what I've been doing with those data sets is I've been like looking at the individual particles because ribosomes are pretty easy to see, and then I've also been taking them and going back through and classifying them to make sure I'm not really missing much, because of course if there's a little class in there I'm missing, I want to get that class.
First off, wow. That is amazing work. What are your thoughts on using difference maps or variance maps to kind of assess heterogeneity and homogeneity of classes?
Yeah, that's really where we're going with this. So maybe using like a diff map or something like that. And if our density is up to a certain volume and all clustered together, we can signify that as difference, as we know from the like the different masses and molecular weights and shapes of our R proteins and our R helices.
Oh, can I ask one question? So you said you didn't find any dead end in the intermediates, right?
Didn't find any what?
Dead end, like...
No.
But from other classes, do you find any dead end?
So we haven't done the same mass spectrometry analysis on some of the other data sets, but these for just by eye looking at it, these classes all look very, very, very similar, so I don't expect any of the other strains would have given a dead end intermediates either. Of course, there could be one that's below our limit of detection on our mass spectrometry experiments, but we don't think so.
Okay, let's give just one more round of applause. So next up is Bill Rice from NYSBC, who's going to tell us how to determine height stiffness using an energy.
Thanks for selecting my poster as one of the ones and as to be chosen for a talk here. And thanks to Clint and Bridget for organizing a really good conference. I'm going to talk about how to determine ice thickness pretty simply and easily during a standard cryo-EM single particle workflow. Because one of the most common questions people ask is, how thick was your ice? And quite often, you know, people just sort of give a guess. Oh, it wasn't too thick, or it was okay, or whatever. So it's better to have a real number. So the idea is to use an energy filter. If you have an energy filtered one, it's very easy to do, basically. And this came about, I think, after we set up two of the cryos 2 and 3 at NYSBC. Bridget was saying we should be able to measure ice thickness easily. And I was like, yeah, we should. So set up a way to do it. The energy filter will separate. Let's see this pointer. The energy filter will automatically separates your...
Sorry, you need a pointer, don't you?
Yeah, is this...
There's another one up there.
This?
Yeah, that's the reason that
works. Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Yeah, so it separates, naturally separates your images into energy loss spectra, and if you don't have a K2, if you have a regular CCD camera, you can collect energy spectra, where this is electron energy on the x-axis and the relative intensity on the y-axis. So you get this very large zero-loss peak. These are the elastically scattered electrons. These are the ones that you want that are forming your image well. That's followed by electrons which have lost some energy, and these are there are sort of two sets. There's the there's the plasmon peak, which is energy electrons which have lost a little bit of energy, and these are the ones that are kind of damaging your specimen. And then at the very end, there's a very, very tiny peak where you can actually do elemental analysis. And if you look at this, compare the size of this peak compared to your zero loss peak, it pretty much means, I think, elemental analysis would be pretty much impossible for cryo-amp samples, because by the time you get enough signal, your protein would be pretty much fried completely, your ice would be gone. But anyways, when you take a normal energy filtered image, you put a slit in, and you basically collect only the zero loss peak, and you get rid of all of this. The electrons which have lost energy are basically, they're no longer following the right electron optics, so they're contributing noise to your sample. So by removing this, you end up increasing your signal-to-noise ratio. So the thickness can be determined by, and this has been known for, since the beginning of energy filters, you can determine the thickness of your sample by integrating the entire spectrum and the zero loss peak. So there's a very simple relationship where the thickness is just what's called the mean free path of inelastic scattering times the log of the ratio of this integrated peak versus the entire spectrum. So on a K2 camera, you can't collect this spectrum, because if you did, this zero loss peak would immediately burn your very expensive camera. But what you can do is just collect two images, one with and without, one with the filters. The slit put in, one without the slit put in, and compare their average intensities, and that gives you the log of the, you can calculate the log of their ratio to get that value. So on the left is a typical energy, an image with the slit in. This is a 15 eV slit, and this is without. And you can probably see there's quite a bit more contrast with the slit in, it does improve the quality of the images quite a bit. You can see your particles quite a bit easier. You can also tell that there's a very obvious gradient of ice in the top right-hand corner. On the right-hand side, the ice is quite a bit thicker, and you wouldn't really see that without using an energy filter. So the next thing you need is to know the mean free path for inelastic scattering in ice, and that one has been determined years ago by several experiments, but mostly at low voltages, at between 80 and 120 kV. And the values then also spread, had quite a spread. I think it was kind of a hard thing to measure. At 300 kV, I found a theoretical measure by Vulevic in 2015. It was around 340 to 350 nanometers. And then there was another measure, basically not using inelastic scattering, but using just electron loss versus with and without, comparing over a vacuum. So I was first of all using this value. But it seemed to be, it was giving me a little bit low values when I compared by measuring the thickness. Alex Noble in our lab, he collected some tomograms of the same samples where I measured thickness, and the thickness was a little bit, well, my thickness was a little bit thinner than what he was seeing. So I then collected a whole bunch of tomograms on some test samples and measured the thickness manually. So this is a sample. This is one of the tomograms I collected. This was a proteasome sample, and it was a fairly thick. The ice wasn't perfect. The ice was kind of thick, but oops. Let's see if I can get this to play. Yeah. This is the very bottom of it. In order to measure the thickness, I basically took the distance between the bottom and the top. The bottom was determined by the very last particle in the image. On this particular image, at the very bottom, even though the ice was thick, the proteins were all in one layer at the top. So there's one little proteasome molecule here, and then as it goes through the tomogram, you'll see them appear here and there, and then when it gets to the very top, you'll kind of see a whole bunch appear, and they're basically sitting at the air-water interface. There's one appearing there, and then here they come. Here's a few, and then there's the full layer. So by measuring the distance between those two, I was able to measure the thickness of the sample, and so I did that for several tomograms. It was very easy to collect in Legendon in just a day's experiment or half a day, and measure the thickness of tomograms versus the log of the relative intensities, and do a plot. And so there's a bit of a scatter in it, obviously, but the slope of this line gives you the mean free path. So the slope I got was an inelastic mean free path of 395 nanometers. That agrees on this scope. So basically, having those two things, it comes with a very simple protocol to measure the thickness. You take an exposure image, you then take a two short images, one without and one with the energy filter, and measure their relative intensities, take the log of that and multiply it by the mean free path. So I've done it on quite a few samples. This is just our current favorite test sample because it's reached 2.5 angstroms. This particular session was very good. It was collected, the grid was prepared and collected by Laura Kim in the lab, and then the processing actually was done by Ed Eng, another SMC scientist. He's pretty much the fastest processor I've ever seen. He manages to do this in a matter of a few hours after collection's done. So this sample reached 2.5 angstrom resolution from around 137,000 particles on Titan Krios with a K2 GIF, and pixel size was about 0.85 angstroms. So when I looked at the analysis of it, I had taken thickness measurements of every picture. Along the x-axis is kind of the image number in this plot, and the y-axis is the thickness measured. So most of the images had exquisitely thin ice. It was between 15 and 20 nanometers. There were some images that basically measured zero. Those ones had no ice, or there were some with extremely thin ice but no particles. And then there was a scattering of samples that had kind of thick ice. They went all the way up to 300 nanometers for some of them. The reason for the blue, for the green and red plots is I was measuring in the red with using the whole micrograph, and green just using the center part of it, just to see if there was much of a difference in case there was some contamination or something. These also were collected. The grid was a gold grid, so it made very nice thin ice. On the right is a plot of the histogram. So this is the thickness in nanometers, and then the number of images. So there was a very large peak of around 350 of the images had a thickness between 10 and 20 nanometers. So it was a very good session. And then basically you could use this to kind of, if you're monitoring during your collection, you could use this to sort of decide if you're collecting in a bad area. Because if you look at the way it goes, there's like a thin area and then suddenly it got thick here, and this kind of must have been a bad square or something, and then more thin and then a few bad squares. So you could kind of try to maybe use this to sort of guide where you're going to image. Here are a couple test images or sample images from it. So this was one of the thin ones. This was measured to be a thickness of 17 nanometers. This is the micrograph on the left. You can see the particles pretty clearly, even though the focus is just less than 1 micron. This sample, it seems to very much like being in pretty much a mat. So I think Alex showed a tomogram of a similar grid where basically the particles are touching each other, but they're all sitting in one layer. And the ice is just thick enough to support this layer. On the panel on the right is the fitting from CTF-FIND4, and then we use in Appian, it gives you also a measure of the fitting. So the tone rings according to Appian, which is pretty similar to the CTF-FIND measure, went to about 2.7 angstrom, so obviously a very high quality image. This is a drift plot, so it didn't drift very much over the period of the exposure, and this is the FFT. The FFT also looked pretty good. There was no really sign of a water ring in this. This is a thicker image. This was 125 nanometers. The particles were still visible, even though it was quite a bit significantly thicker. The defocus of this one is a little higher. This one happened to be about almost 1.8 micron under focus. The tone rings didn't go nearly as far, and probably that was because the ice was quite a bit thicker. The drift was actually less than the other image. But if you look at the FFT of it, there's a very strong ice ring. So this kind of is an indication of when you're starting getting thick ice, from what I see, you see this ice ring definitely become much more prominent than when you have thin ice. I also did a plot, finally analyzing this, is of how far out the tone rings went versus the thickness. So this is the thickness of the sample in the x-axis and how far out they went in the y-axis. And so there was a nice sweet spot of between 15 and 20 nanometers where most of them lay, and the tone rings went out to better than 4 angstroms for the most part. And then as you get thicker and thicker, the tone ring resolution went worse, as you might expect with thicker ice. There seem to be two plots of it. I'm not sure why. One hypothesis might be that the one where it gets thicker, where it gets worse faster, that maybe there are two layers. The ice is thick enough to support two layers, as Alex showed. There might be particles here on the top and bottom, and perhaps when it doesn't go as far as just at the at top or bottom, but that's just kind of a hypothesis. This has now been integrated into Legendon now, so I kind of made a new node called Ice Thickness, and so you can basically turn it on and off, and you can set the for how long the exposure you want to be, and the slit width, and the mean free path. And then that basically lets you put it in there, and then all this data can be collected in Legendon and then go along with your session along with all the other metadata. So in conclusion, so I think this is easy to measure with an energy filter, as Bridget said. You just have to do it. I think the thing with automation, it could easily be scripted. And so I think it's probably worth doing if you're collecting on a microscope that has it. The thickness measurements can be integrated into standard workflow, and it could probably be used as a guide for initial screening. And so thanks to Clint and Bridget. They've grown the center amazingly. We went from 3 people to more than 20 people in just over 2 years, and it's working really amazingly well. And thanks also to the entire SEMC Ops and NRAM teams at NYSBC and people who let me use their sessions to do some tests.
Very nice, very handy. I'm really struck by the image you showed with and without the energy filter. The image looks so much nicer with the energy filter. But does the final resolution of maps typically get better with an energy filter? I know, does Creos 1 give you worse structures than Creos 2 and 3?
No, I wouldn't say. I don't think we haven't done a test of the same grid with and without the energy filter. I will say I think it probably makes it a lot easier to find and pick the particles. I don't think I can say conclusively that it makes it better. And for highest resolution. I think Anchi might be talking about that in her talk. But tomorrow, yeah.
Hey, Bill, really nice work. It's about time somebody sort of put this into the whole queue of how things get measured. I was sort of curious, the measurement for mean free path that you got was lower than what was calculated. Could it be that the protein in the image maybe?
Yeah. It was higher. They calculated about 350, and I got 395, I think. But I think from their theoretical curve, the protein should give a lower mean free path. So
yeah, that's true.
It does depend on the optics, like the objective aperture and all that.
What mag are you? You're using an exposure mag then, right?
This was exposure mag, yeah.
Hey, Bill.
Oh.
So on your plot of like resolution limit, tone rings versus thickness, there was a bunch that were thin but really bad images.
Yeah. So
what do you think happened there?
I think those ones either had no ice or the ice was too thin to have any particles.
Do particles from thick layers of ice have a stronger tendency to be discarded during classification or not?
I have to look at that. I have to do. We can now import the Legendon things and the rely on things into Appian. So I'll have to have a look. But I suspect so. But I would have to check.
Okay, let's give Bill one more round of applause. Last speaker is Alex Rizzo, who is going to tell us about the translocation mechanism of HSP-104 disaggregase.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank the committee for selecting my poster and also NRAM for putting this great conference together. As someone that's new to EM, it's really great to be in a workshop that provides a lot of information in a short period of time. So I'm Alex Rizzo. I'm in Dan Southworth's lab. And so I'm going to talk about some exciting work that we've been doing in the lab for about a year and a half now. And it's been some really cool work that I got to do once I joined the lab. And so to begin, HSP-104 is a AAA protein. But in general, there's been a lot of research done on AAA machines and kind of that their main role and function is translocation. And so we have the 100s family that focuses on disaggregation, but we also have other AAA machines like the proteasome that's important for degradation, as well as something like DNA helicase that is important for unwinding DNA. But a lot of structures have been determined. However, we really don't know how the motor mechanism of these machines work. And so specifically, what is the substrate interaction mechanism? How do they use ATP hydrolysis to drive translocation, as well as any conformation changes that occur? And so kind of to give a brief introduction to HSP-104, HSP-104 is a disaggregate that can solubilize different types of aggregates as well as amyloid fibers. And so HSP-104 is a hexameric protein that uses ATP hydrolysis to allow for translocation down the central channel. It's known that HSP-70 and 40 help to bring substrate to 104. And so with our collaborators at UPenn, they've done a lot of characterization of 104 and specifically showing that it's capable of actually solubilizing human disease amyloids in these yeast systems. And so 104, just kind of give a sequence identity here. So there's two, it's a type 2 AAA protein. It has two nucleotide binding domains as well as tyrosine pore loops. And these tyrosine pore loops are super important in the substrate threading process, and they're fairly well conserved in many of these translocases as well as the NBDs. And so this was the first paper that we published on 104, which was this HSP-104 with AMP-PNP. And what we found was that it had this very unique spiral architecture. And what was even more interesting for us was that it had this very wide open 30 angstrom channel and also this asymmetric hexamer seam between the different NBDs of the two different protomers. And so based upon this, we really wanted to know what would happen when substrate binds to this complex, specifically to 104. And also, too, we wanted to look at, we knew that these tyrosine pore loops were conserved, but were they actually playing a role in the mechanism? And so, like I mentioned before, we collaborate with James Schroeder's lab at the University of Pennsylvania. So they did a FP analysis for us, which basically showed that with different nucleotides and our model substrate casein, we really didn't see very high binding affinity. However, when we use FITC casein with ATP gamma S, the slowly hydrolyzable ATP analog, we saw much higher binding affinity. And so we kind of went with this substrate and this nucleotide state to move to building complex and using it for cryo-EM. And so we successfully made complex and took our peak fraction where casein was bound to 104, and we went ahead and used that sample for cryo-EM. And so these are just a couple of the 2D class averages. And basically, you can see that from these, you could see that this is a top-down view, that the central channel was now closed and that there was a lot different kind of structure of how these domains were lined up. And so if you compare them to the 2D class averages of AMP-PNP data set with them in the same orientation, you can see that there's significant differences and that there are, we had to delve deeper into what was going on. And so using 3D classification, we were able to distinguish two distinct substrate bound states of 104. And so we use an initial model of just a planar state here, and so we identified two different states. And so basically these two blue structures here, we took that, it was about 32% of our data, so about 150,000 particles, and we got our closed map at 4 angstroms. And then from there, we identified another state, these orange classes, and those were classified down, and about only 15% of the data then was taken, and that was used for our extended map at 4.1 angstroms. And so moving forward, I'll just kind of showcase these protomers colored as well as labeled P1 through P6 and that counterclockwise. But from this structure, we were able to identify, and what we were really excited about was we got to have substrate down the central channel. And we can see as this movie plays that there are specific contacts being made with the central channel substrate and that most of all the protomers are making direct contacts. And what we also found what was interesting was that this mobile face, or this P1 and P6, was kind of where our lowest resolution was. However, if we cut into the map and we look at the resolution of the central channel, that was where we got our highest resolution. So we really wanted to understand now what these contacts were with this substrate down the central channel. And so if we have here, we have the closed state map. And so we focus on the NBD1 tyrosines up here, and then the NBD2 tyrosines in the bottom. And so if we play this video and we wrap around the substrate, we see specific interactions between each protomer. But if you were paying close attention, this bottom one has a protomer missing. And so we didn't see an interaction with the NBD2 of that protomer 6. However, we see it up here making contact. But if we compare a different map and with the extended state, we can see that we now have a change up here, as well as that additional protomer tyrosine loop now interacting down here. And so this is shown here, where we see a kind of a increase of this protomer reaching up, and then we also see contact here with that protomer that was missing in the closed state. And so it's also close to mention that this P5, which was this blue one, was at the highest point in the closed state, but in the extended state, it's now that P6 tyrosine loop. And so this will kind of showcase how this conformation change may be helping to move these protomers up into their extended state, and how this may be playing a role in substrate disaggregation through the central channel. And so another thing that we wanted to look at, we knew that ATPase activity plays an important role in AAA proteins, and so specifically we wanted to look at the nucleotide pockets. And with the resolution that we were able to get, we could focus in on these individual nucleotide binding pockets. And so here we have NBD1, and then down here we have NBD2. And so with the protomers 3 through 5, which would be on that non-mobile interface, we see that they're close enough where the arginine finger is interacting with that gamma phosphate and that nucleotide binding pocket. And that's the same thing with NBD2. However, if we look at the P6 protomer, which is on the active interface, we can see in the closed state, this distance is about 12 angstroms, and there's not significant interaction. However, that changes in the extended state, where we see it making close contact. And so from here, we decided or determined that the P6 becomes activated in the extended state upon substrate binding, and that the mobile protomers actively hydrolyze ATP upon binding and releasing of substrate. And so here I'm going to show you guys a movie of basically this rotary mechanism that we proposed that we obtained from determining these two different classes. And so here we have the extended state, where we see two residue translocation step, and then we go to the closed state here, back to the extended, and this will continue to ratchet around each protomer counterclockwise around the hexamer until that substrate is threaded all the way down the central channel. And so it's important to note that this was a two amino acid translocation step, and that these protomers switch from that high-low position, and that this HPase activity is required for this motion to occur. And so there's still questions that remain about this mechanism and whether it's conserved throughout binding to different substrates. We know 104 can recognize a lot of substrates, as well as how does substrate get loaded on. And so moving forward with the project, I just joined the lab last year, and so I'm going to start looking at, this is some size exclusion trace that basically shows that complex formation can occur with HSP70 and 104 along with casein. So I have some initial data that's getting processed to try to get a complex and show the unloading of the substrate onto 104. So I'd like to conclude, and as this video plays, kind of just showing what we hope maybe would be happening in the cell. But I would like to thank Dan Southworth, my PI, as well as Stephanie Gates and Adam Yoakum that just graduated from the lab, but worked on this project for the rest of their PhD while they're at Michigan, as well as other people in the Southworth lab, Min, who runs our microscopes at Michigan. And so I'll be making the move to San Francisco here in January. But right now I'm spending my time at LSI finishing up. But yeah, I would like to answer any questions you may have.
A very nice talk. I have a question. So in terms of the Alzheimer's disease, if you have an amyloid fiber protein, how does it bind to the 1-4? The channel size is quite small for...
Correct, yeah. And so that's something that we would definitely like to start looking into is these actual amyloid fibrils and stuff that has more of a biological role to health. So like I had mentioned before, 70 helps to load substrate. That mechanism is still a little bit not completely figured out and how 70 binds to 104. So I think that's kind of the next question to answer your question of how we can actually look at amyloid fibrils.
Very nice work. So I'm a little confused though. The extended state, that was the ATP gamma S.
Correct.
Was there substrate bound in that state?
Yes, there is substrate bound in both states. Included this slide since we didn't show it that much in a movie. So so this is the extended state here. And so the only main differences that we see is this bottom down here kind of being.
So that doesn't have the 30 angstrom open pore. That's still relatively.
Correct, yes, it's not 30.
I see, okay.
Yeah, the only, we've never been able to get a spiral state with substrate. So it's always empty. We've tried it with casein as well as doing different nucleotides. We've never been able to capture that state. So we believe that the spiral state would actually accept substrate and then it would move between the closed and extended.
Okay, because you can also make a rotary mechanism from any asymmetric state just propagating the asymmetry around the ring. So I guess the question is which states are involved and which order they go in.
Correct, yes, and that's something that I think kind of seeing if this is a conserved mechanism and how it changes upon binding to different substrate is important, something that we're going to look at.
So quick question here. So the substrate binding initially, it's only required N-domain, not the ATPase domain, right?
Correct.
So, but why the other nucleotide doesn't, just don't bind the substrate in other conditions?
Yeah, so we think that with the different nucleotide states, it requires the ATPase activity. So that means in these non-hydrolyzable ATP analogs like AMP, PMP, it's not going to have the ATPase activity to go between these different states, which would allow for it not to be able to bind substrate.
All right, if there's no more questions, let's give Alex one more round of applause.